Hey, Richard Gottlieb.
It's Burns.
How you doing?
I'm great. We're going to get Funko today.
We are going to have a bunch of fun with Funko Games. We have got with us Deirdre Cross, who is Vice President of Funko Games, Sales, Marketing, and Business Development. She's joining us from Seattle, where it's traditional Seattle weather now again, gray and rainy, which I always loved when I was there on Pictionary. And Deirdre, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Thank you, Richard. It's such a pleasure to be here with you today. Thank you.
And this is the Playground Podcast with me, Chris Byrne, and my cohort and co-host, Richard Gottlieb. We are brought to you by global toy experts, The Toy Guy, and marketing and media agency, Chizcom. So, Deirdre, tell us your story. How did you get to be VP lots of stuff for Funko?
Oh my gosh. What a journey it's been, Chris. I've been in the game business for almost 15 years. This is my 15th year. It's been really exciting. I think our journey to becoming Funko Games is interesting because I've been on this particular team for all these years, but Funko Games is only about 2.5 years old. Our studio was Forrest Pruzan Creative, and you may have heard of us. I know you've played a lot of our games over the years. We invented many of the early Cranium preschool games, Hullabaloo, Caribou. I'm sure you guys know all of those.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So we're really industry veterans here at FPC, Forrest Pruzan Creative. And we were independent game inventors, product developers, inventing and developing games for all sorts of publishers all over the world. And Funko was a client of ours, and they were very pumped about games, and they decided to jump in with both feet, I mean, big time. And they acquired our studio here in Seattle to form Funko Games as its own entity within the larger Funko organization. And it's been amazing.
And tell us a little bit about some of the games you do. You do a broad range of games. You do the Funkoverse, you do licensed games with Marvel. One of your new preschool games is one of my favorites. It's based on the It's a Small World attraction at Walt Disney World. And my joke about that is you can play the game and not get stuck in the boat for 20 minutes trying to get out of there.
Well, if we did our job right, it's going to keep moving along. But yeah, we have a really broad catalog because our roots are as game inventors and developers, we were already developing games from the strategy section through party, kid, family, preschool, and the card game section of the aisle. And so when we became Funko Games, we brought all of that innovation that comes in each of those spaces to Funko to really create a full suite of product offering.
As Chris knows, I'm fascinated by business culture. And here you are originally, you guys were pretty independent people, totally on the creative side in the game business, and you were purchased by a company that was pretty crazy in its own way, too. Made its mark in collectible toys, but not in the game business. So how are you merging the business culture?
Richard, I think you kind of hit on something interesting there, because Funko did not have a game team already. But what they did have was this incredible pop culture. And just, they are, as a company, just known for really celebrating the fan and the deep fandom of something. You know, if you look at something then like our It's a Small World game, you can tell that the people who made it are incredible fans of the Disney parks. Deep fandom is radiating from these products. Between our two organizations, the game entity and Funko at large, we come to these opportunities from that same lens. So there's a lot of synergy there. But like you said, games is a very different business and a different discipline than the collectibles business. And that's where Funko acquiring a separate company and setting us up as its own division really set us up for success, because what they have over here are people who are dedicated, passionate, career game people. And so we understand that part of the business in a different way. That's important because it is distinct and different. And over the years, as Forest Prusan Creative, we saw many companies try to get into the game space, toy companies try to get into the game space. And it is hard because you have to have deep knowledge and sustained energy behind those big initiatives, because it's not an easy space to crack into.
You mentioned that the game sector is a hard one to crack into. It sure as heck is. I've been working in games for a long time, and you see a lot more disasters than you see successes. Seriously. And what is it? But you guys have an incredible track record of making successes. So what is your magic? What is it that you bake into your games that makes them so successful?
Oh my gosh, you're going to bring me on here and have me tell everyone what our magic is?
Of course.
Well, you know what, Chris? I think part of the magic is the deep fandom, the way we connect to the property. And even if we're developing something for preschool, right, we're bringing it into the room with kids and families, playtesting the product and really looking for the joy. Where is the joy? And filtering out all that other stuff that doesn't serve the game. And you can have a tendency, especially if you're looking for games for 3 and 4 year olds, to make them more complicated, because we like games and we're game people. But we're bringing new people into it, looking for sort of how to distill the idea, how to make it approachable, how to bring new people into it, and like kind of keep winnowing it down until you get to something really wonderful that connects with people. And in our experience, when we are making games in the hands of consumers, with them in the room, putting it in front of them and having them play things, we're constantly looking for that joy, and we're constantly looking for what's not working. So longitudinally in the aisle, if you have a great product, beautiful packaging, all those kind of things, longitudinally speaking, once you get it there, to keep it there, it has to connect with the consumer in a really visceral and meaningful way in their life, whether that's because they're giving it as a gift and it delights people, or if they are bringing it to their child as a first game experience. We're also driven by those customer reviews and that customer reaction. But games is also huge word of mouth, right? You're bringing so many people to the table. So
literally.
Exactly. It's different than toys, right? The toy you give to the child runs off and it plays. With a game, you bring it to the table and you're going to have an experience together. What does that mean to you? So it is magic. There's something in there that's magic.
We're very much into the 21st century. And I think we can agree that children are different in many ways than they were when we were children. And I'm just wondering, do you find that they approach gameplay in a different manner than previous generations?
It's really an interesting question. I think we do see the window narrowing in some ways for ages of children who are playing games, because they do reach an age where they want to play video games and that stuff is attractive. But I remember 10 years ago, right? And apps, all these apps are starting to come out, and apps are the end of the game aisle, right? We all thought you were there, right? We all thought games were dead.
Right. We did. The sky was falling.
The sky was falling. What are we going to do? Apps are the future. Board games are dead. Well, here we are. We're all still here. And the games are bigger than ever. Now, what has changed? The children maybe have changed. Their entertainment has changed. But the other thing that has happened is that opportunity for kids and parents to sit at the table together and connect personally to one another has become even more important than it was a decade or more ago.
I completely agree with that. Several years ago, a major game company brought out a series of games that had a tablet in the middle of the game board. And they, you know, this was tech, and this was going to marry the app and the game, and it was going to be a breakthrough. Well, it was a terrible game. They were terrible because people ended up sitting around looking at the tablet and not looking at one another. And Brian Hirsch, who is a game inventor from the 80s, used to say that games bring people together, and that was really the function of them. He called it social lubrication, and that was the function of a game, was to bring people together.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. And if we can create something that creates that moment that brings families together, and we're making the right game that's connecting with them in a meaningful way, they'll still go back to their screen. They've still got 3 hours of screen time they're going to spend today. But for right now, they're at the table and they're having a meaningful connection with their family. And I think that's one of the big reasons we saw board games really expand last year during the tighter part of the lockdown, the pandemic, was that sort of that backlash, right? We've got to fill this time with something, and please, for the love of God, no more screens.
it's very true. And I have always felt that games, family games, are very empowering to children, because it's the only time they sit at the table and their parents have to follow the same rules that they have. And it just puts them all at the same level. And I think that's a real kick for kids. And I think it's a kick for their parents, too.
Games are not immune from being fashion or trendy. In the mid-60s, we had Marvin Glass and all of those games like Mousetrap and Kerplunk and Booby Trap and all of that. And recently, we had a resurgence of what we sort of called the skill in action game. But you guys don't do that. You guys do much more classic games. What is your philosophy that you start from when you're making a game?
Yeah. Well, Chris, we look for what the opportunity is, and that might be that we start from an IP. A lot of our games, especially with Funko, are licensed, though we do non-licensed as well. And we try to think about, you know, what's the opportunity? Is it that family moment where we want to bring people together? Is it tying something to It's a Small World or whatever license? Like, we start from there, and then we think about what is, you know, what's the white space opportunity? Kind of use an inside term there. What's the opportunity that puts this on the shelf and puts this in the hands of consumers? So if everybody's making games about poop, we might identify that as, you know, okay, well, that's this year. What's the next thing? That's passé.
I would like to ask you about poop-based games.
Okay.
P-O-O, not P-O-O-H, unfortunately.
We have been inundated, or where we were inundated, in every kind of bodily orifice game. I've wondered, and I wanted to ask you this, because you're in this space. Do these games sell because they're the novelty and the gross appeal? And once they're home, is this something that children continue to play, or is it more of a novelty item than it is a game?
Yeah. That's a great question, Richard. I think kids always like, my cousin just the other day was like, when do boys grow out of poop and fart jokes? Like, and I was like, I don't think they do.
Never.
Like, never. Like, I'm not sure it ever happens. So I think boys especially, but girls too, think it's funny, and it'll continue to be funny. And when you're thinking about the purchase decision in the aisle, right? Mom's like, okay, how am I going to cut through this? I'm going to tell a joke about poop, and it's going to be funny. I don't know if the games continue to get played long term. I don't know if they're creating an heirloom sort of family experience. But I, you know, if we think back to sort of the pie face phenomenon, you know, right, 6 years ago, whatever that was, now people are really, everybody's looking for that, right? And hoping to get there with these other jokes.
To me, as an example, all those Monopoly games, Kitty Monopoly and Puppy Monopoly, were not really games. They were collectibles because I don't think people play Kitty Monopoly. You know, you get a gift for somebody and they like kitties, and so you give them Kitty Monopoly. But it takes up a lot of space in the game section. Do you feel like games are getting sufficient space in physical retail?
Well, we would always like to get more space at physical retail. And I think some of the bigger retailers are giving games more space, especially over the last couple years. We're seeing a lot more end caps and things like that around games. It's very interesting to think about that purchase decision, why people are buying, what they're going into the store to buy. You know, in our research, maybe even 50% of people who buy games, maybe 50% of their purchases, they did not go into the store planning to make, which means when they walk through that aisle, something caught their eye, something jumped into their cart. And is that because they're connecting, like, oh, right, Sarah's got a birthday, she likes kitties, let's get that kitty Monopoly? Or is it, that thing is beautiful, I've got to have that crazy Bob Ross game in my life, and let's have, you know, let's build a party around it. Like, what's the moment? How is it doing that? And the physical game aisle really serves that purpose, right? A billboard opportunity for your product in a way that is still extremely valuable.
We mentioned before Disney and the It's a Small World game, but another license that you have is a classic license that is probably going on almost 70 years old, right? Dr. Seuss. And one of the early games you did was the Dr. Seuss I Can Do That game. And this is a personal story because I started bugging Wonderforge at the time to do a game based on my favorite Seuss book, Happy Birthday to You. And you finally did it. And I can recite the entire book for you, but I will not. I will spare all our listeners. But what finally got you to do that game?
Chris, it's been on our list since at least 2008. No, I think it was just opportunity, really, that sort of kept us from doing it until now. But we love this book as well, Happy Birthday to You. And the book is such a gift for the birthday, and the game is a gift as well. I mean, it's just, it's all right there. And it's for 3 and up, which is really nice because actually we've sort of engineered it so that your child could play it every year on their birthday, you know, while they're still in that age range, like right. 3 to 5.
Right. Yeah. And you made a special occasion. The other thing you were talking about, walking by and seeing something on the shelf. You guys also do something that not a lot of people do. You invest in your packaging. Your packaging makes a statement. I mean, I was laughing because I was going, spot varnish! You know, but really, you invest in your packaging. So if it does, giving it a chance to jump off the shelf, what's that about? Why are you doing that where other people are cutting costs?
We know when we set out to make a product what our cost of goods target is, right? And if we've still got 5 cents left in that target goal, and we can put foil on the box or glitter on the box, or there's something else we can do to make it extra special, we're going to do that. I mean, even things like, you'll see a lot of our products, even the inside of the box has a liner.
The inside of one of our boxes is like a rainbow in there.
Right. Yeah. It's a birthday rainbow over Coutru.
It's a birthday.
It's happy birthday.
It's yeah. Not gray or brown cardboard. It's extremely colorful.
Right, because I think the games Richard and I grew up with, you opened the box and it was cheap cardboard that was wrapped, but the directions were printed on the inside of the box in black ink that often ran.
Right. But when we think about what we can do on the outside of the box, like, If we can, I mean, I'm holding up the Mad Tea Party game. Like, it's got this copper colored foil, which it's just like these things. Think about, you know, you're walking through the store and you got your kids with you and everybody's hanging off of you and it's crazy and something catches your eye. That's what we're trying to do. We make it beautiful. And then also when you get it home, it is designed to live in your game closet and with your family and in your life for decades to come. It is an heirloom quality.
A package like that demands you approach.
There is a lot of talk about that, thinking about consumers. And if you can get them to pick up the product, you're halfway to the cart, right? If they'll pick it up and turn it over rather than them just walking by being like, oh, that's cute. Like, we want them to pick it up. And if it demands that it be touched, I mean, sometimes we do things that have flocking or, you know, a couple years ago, we did a Bob Ross game called Happy Little Accidents. And in his hair, his big, beautiful hair, we did it brown flocked and the logo was inside of his hair. That was one of those things, like, what a crazy, like, here's the head of Bob Ross and it's all fuzzy and people, and I also like to lurk in the game aisle. You guys maybe do this too, kind of lurk, see what people are picking up.
We've been arrested.
You guys, okay, you can't get away with it, but I can. And so I like to lurk and watch, and I can't tell you, like, when the packages are blinged out like this, people are picking them up and taking a look, and that's half the battle.
There was a time, probably in the 90s into the early 2000s, when licensed games were pretty blah. I mean, it was basically your basic chase game with a label with the characters on them. But you guys have delved into the licenses. Your Cat in the Hat game, is it really feels like you are stacking up the stuff like the Cat in the Hat does to make a mess. Or it really feels like you are actually within It's a Small World. What's your process of dealing with a license and bringing it to life, whatever that license might be?
The first thing we do, Chris, is we take a really deep dive into the IP. That deep dive is about understanding that how the property makes you feel, right? When you watch Jaws, you're like, all that tension on the backside, right? What's going to happen? Where's the shark? I don't know. Like, how does it make you feel? And then when we're playing it, we're looking for how does it make us feel. In the Cat in the Hat, do we feel like wild and out of control because thing one and thing two are taking over? Do we feel a whole bunch of tension because a shark is after us? What do we feel in the property as fans of the property? And then how do we translate that to the tabletop?
Can you talk a little bit about the not so happy side of game inventing, and maybe when things go wrong or they don't turn out as hoped for? What's that like in terms of keeping going?
Wow. I think about that, the struggle of the independent inventor, having lived that. And also when I see it out in the world, you know, and you see folks who are like, I've got this one big game idea. And we also have we call it the closet, but it's this huge room and it has 1,000+ game inventions in it that have not yet gone to market. And some of them are, we think, truly brilliant. When we were independent game inventors, you know, we would go to Toy Fair, Nuremberg, and schlep big cases and pitch. Oh my gosh, I've pitched so much and everything. And there's so many things that fall by the wayside. You have to take so many at-bats. So many at-bats to get a grand slam. I mean, talk about the game of life. That is the ultimate goal, to create something that lives on the shelf for 80+ years. Like, that's just a phenom that lives in, it's a must have for everybody in their home. We've had the good luck of inventing a few things that have been on the shelf for a decade or more, which is pretty darn good.
Very good.
But in my time here, I've worked on about 500 games that have gone to market, and 1,000 at least that are in prototype form in the closet, unpublished. And for every one that's on the shelf, right, how many versions of each of these games existed along the way? Because as we're developing something here, we have a standing army of game inventors and developers, not to mention all the other people who are also ideating around them. We're ideating all sorts of things. So for any one game that's on the shelf, there might have been, you know, 30 or 40 games that we tried to make for that. You have to be relentless, not just in your dedication to making great product, but in sort of the belief that you're going to get to something great, that you're going to find an opportunity for your product, and relentless in just being like, that one didn't work, try again. That one didn't work, try again. And it is a tenacity that I think is part of the advantage that Funko has by having us as an independent team.
I love hearing that. And when I'm listening to you talk, it's like a lot of the creative people I talk to, Richard knows, and I have done in the past, it's hopefully coming back, doing a lot with the theater. And listening to you talk about that is almost verbatim what I hear about the background of getting Dear Evan Hansen or some musical to Broadway. It's that tenacity. It's that getting up when you're knocked down. It's also the vision and the belief that you've got something.
Yeah, it is. And it's no coincidence either that there are so many people on our team that have theater backgrounds, that have film backgrounds, like that we are creative people coming from creative collaborative backgrounds. The show must go on. Here we go. Like, we're losing daylight. We got to make the day work. Let's make it happen. And it's this sort of esprit de corps and just drive to want to be the best in everything that we do.
You know, I've never thought of it quite this way before, but when you open that box at the table, you actually are putting on a show in a sense. I have never thought of it quite in that way before.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's how we think about it. Every bit of it, when you're opening it up, what's the back of the game board look like? What story does it tell? Look at our Goonies game. Why did we commission this big painting of Astoria and the House on the Hill when you're just going to put it face down on the table? Because when you open it, we're setting the scene, we're setting the tone, we're putting you in an environment, and it all starts right then.
Okay, Deirdre, we're going to ask you the question we ask all our guests on the Playground podcast.
Okay.
Tell us a secret.
A secret about me is that I have a world-famous cat.
I love that. Tell me.
So my cat... Cooper, the photographer cat. And so he became sort of famous for, we mounted a camera on his collar, and he had several appearances on Animal Planet on various shows.
Wow,
and
just, you have a famous cat.
He became one of the first big famous internet cats. He has over 1 million followers on Facebook. And predates Grumpy Cat even. So that's kind of a, that was like my strange side hustle, was having a famous cat.
Did you get him the Kitty Monopoly?
Nope, he's not. He's in some video games, which is a strange. I'm like, what? Really? Okay. But no, he's not. He's not in any board games.
Well, this has been amazing. What a pleasure talking to you. I love playing your games. I love talking about games. I love talking to you about this. So, Deirdre Cross, VP Funko Games, Sales, Marketing, and Business Development, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks, Richard. It's really been a pleasure to talk with you today. Thank you.
This is the Playground Podcast, and we'll be right back with the end cap. And now we come to the part of the show that we call the end cap, where Richard and I talk about issues and people in the toy industry. And today we are remembering an industry icon, Ruben Klamer, who passed away recently at the age of 99, inventor of the Game of Life and many others, and a fixture at toy industry events for years, somebody I had a chance to meet early on in my career. But Richard, you have some wonderful memories of Ruben. Please share them with us.
So Ruben invited me out to his home in Southern California because he was working on his autobiography. He wanted me to give him some feedback and maybe help a little bit with some writing. And he told me some fantastic stories when I was there, but a few of them really stand out. And one of them is, for those of us who have been around a while, can remember the original Man from U.N.C.L.E. television show, which featured a very special gun, and Ruben didn't create that gun. He created the gun for the show. And because of that, he got a call from Gene Roddenberry. Yes, that Gene Roddenberry, who was developing Star Trek at the time and was about to do his second pilot. And he called Ruben, and Ruben went out there and met with him and Shatner. And Ruben said, well, when do you need it? And Roddenberry said, 2 weeks. And Rick said, 2 weeks. And he said, Shatner jumped to his feet and said, look, we're all in this together. And Ruben said, I just got here. So he has fantastic stories. He was involved with the Pink Panther, created the Pink Panther car, which was an actual car that went around to different events. He was a war hero, World War II. He saved lives during a battle by repeatedly jumping into the water and rescuing sailors. His dad was a barrel salesman, and he would go out to the Schmucker's Jelly Company and buy barrels and sell them to scotch makers in Scotland because they liked the barrels because they had the jelly had been embedded into the barrel. But I think that the thing that I came away with mostly was his humility and is his notion that his warehouse was the warehouse of broken dreams, that for all his success with inventing the game of life and the no rollback skate and so many other products, that he had maybe 10 times as many failures as he had successes. And I think that's an important lesson to learn in life, that you got to just keep at it.
He was a lovely man. I don't know if he remembered me, but he always made a show of saying he did whenever I saw him. So
I'm sure he did.
But yeah, he was one of the industry icons. He was one of those larger than life figures within the toy industry, though he, as you say, was very humble. But he really was an icon, and he will certainly be missed. He's a member of the Toy Industry Hall of Fame, and certainly somebody that we're delighted to pay tribute to today.
And I would just like to say, Chris, he told me that he had invented a Marx Brothers fake nose and glasses. And he had to go to the country club and have lunch with Groucho Marx's brother so he could sign off on the nose. And he literally signed the nose.
I love these stories of the toy industries. Thank you for tuning in. We'll have many more stories to come. This is the Playground Podcast with me, Chris Byrne, my co-host and cohort, Richard Gottlieb. And we are brought to you by Global Toy Experts, The Toy Guy, marketing and media agency Chiscom. Please share these episodes with your friends and stay tuned for our next episode. Thanks for listening.